Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us for this national telebriefing to update the public on the status of the Fukushima nuclear accidents. I am Tim Judson, the Executive Director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, which is hosting the briefing, and I'll be your host tonight. We are pleased that so many of you could be here tonight. This is our second year of providing these international briefings to provide people in the U.S. and around the world with in-depth information on urgent issues relating to nuclear power, sustainable energy, radioactive waste, and the public health risks of radiation. These briefings are all open to the public for anyone to attend. While we primarily invite people to attend these briefings through our email list of supporters and our followers on social media, we encourage you to spread the word to anyone you think would be interested in the topics our briefings cover. For those of you not familiar with NIRS, we are the primary national information and resource center for the anti-nuclear and safe energy movement in the U.S. For the last 36 years, we have worked to end the use of nuclear power in the United States and for technically sound, environmentally just, and publicly acceptable solutions for radioactive waste. We provide support to grassroots activists and local campaigns, and we serve as a watchdog in Washington, D.C., leading campaigns on national policy issues such as the Mobile Chernobyl bill and taxpayer subsidies to build new reactors. But to be successful, we need your support, both in taking action on the issues and, just as importantly, in whatever financial support you can provide to our work. If you feel NIRS's work is important, please consider making a contribution. Right now, we are in the midst of a major crowdfunding campaign for the Michael Marriott Legacy Fund. Legacy Fund will help us build a new generation of activists for a nuclear-free, carbon-free future and advance the legacy of NIRS's president and my predecessor as executive director, Michael Marriott, including helping us mobilize for the next round of United Nations climate talks in Paris later this year. Just as we see in the United States now, we expect industry to make an enormous push for nuclear power to be a major element of whatever comes out of the Paris Climate Conference. You can find a link to the Legacy Fund campaign on our website or our Facebook page, or go there directly at legacyfund.nirs.org. Don't include the www, just legacyfund.nirs.org. Now on to our program. It is more important now than ever for people in the United States to remain informed about the nuclear accidents in Fukushima. While mainstream media attention to the nuclear disaster has undoubtedly waned, it is clear from the attendance here tonight that public concern about it has not. Hundreds of people registered to participate tonight, even more than did for the briefing we held on the third anniversary last year. We hope tonight's presentations will give you the information you need to sort through conflicting and too often inaccurate information about what is happening at Fukushima and what you can do about it. Those of us in the U.S. need to understand the real impact of the disaster and what the Japanese people are contending with, as well as what needs to be done to get the disaster under control and ensure the same thing does not happen again. It is with those needs in mind that we put together tonight's program. We have tonight three leaders and experts who will share information and have been on the front lines responding to the situation at Fukushima since the accident started. We're going to begin with a presentation by Mr. Akira Kawasaki, the director of Peace Boat Japan, who will update us on the status of the Fukushima site and the challenges that the local residents and people in the contaminated areas are facing. He'll be followed by Eileen Miyoko-Smith, who will discuss the plans for the restart of reactors throughout Japan, and will conclude with a presentation by David Lockbaum, the nuclear safety engineer at the Union of Concerned Scientists, to talk about some of the ways in which nuclear regulators in the U.S. have failed to learn the lessons of Fukushima. In a moment, we will get started, but first I just have a few instructions of how we will handle questions and answers tonight. Because of the large number of participants, everyone has been muted. At the end of each presentation, we will have 10 to 12 minutes for questions and answers. To ask a question, just dial *6, then when prompted, press 1 to be added to the question and answer queue. When it is your turn, you will be notified that you are unmuted and you may ask your question. We are sure that there will be plenty of questions tonight, and we want to make sure we cover as much information as possible. To that end, we ask that everyone make their questions as concise as possible and refrain from making long statements. So now, on with our program. First, we are going to hear from Akira Kawasaki, who will update us on the status of the TEPCO site and the concerns facing those affected by the accidents and ongoing contamination. Mr. Kawasaki is an executive committee member of the Tokyo-based NGO Peace Boat and a co-chair of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. After the March 11, 2011 tsunami and nuclear disaster, he initiated Peace Boat's activities to help children of Fukushima and organize the Global Conference for a Nuclear Power-Free World in January 2012. He is the co-author of the new booklet, 10 Lessons from Fukushima, Reducing Risks and Protecting Communities from Nuclear Disasters. He lectures at Keisen University, Tokyo, and frequently writes in Japanese newspapers on journals on nuclear disarmament. For more information, please visit www.peaceboat.org. Akira, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Tim, for inviting me and also giving me this great opportunity to share with you what is happening in Fukushima and also how the people of Japan perceive the situation now. And I'm talking to you from Tokyo. So as the fourth anniversary approaches, civil society groups working on nuclear power issue and also assisting the people of Fukushima are accelerating their efforts to highlight the issue nationwide and also internationally. And in this timing, the government of Japan is hosting a world conference on disarmament risk reduction. This is a UN conference, and it is going to take place this week in a city of Sendai, which is north of Fukushima and a heavily affected area by tsunami and earthquake 4 years ago. So the concept of the government is to focus on the disaster risk reduction internationally and appeal to the international society that the country is steadily rebuilding. But the problem is that the discussion of this world conference is trying to intentionally neglect nuclear power dimension. So civil society groups have been advocating the proper inclusion of the nuclear disaster dimension or nuclear power plants dimension in the discussion on disaster risk reduction. And partly as a result of our efforts, now this world conference is having a dimension of man-made hazards in their terminology, in addition to the natural hazards in the official discussion of the World Conference. So it's a bit of a success. At least they opened a scope to include this nuclear dimension in the discussion. And civil society groups get united in a form of a Japanese platform of civil society and holding a series of meetings in Fukushima and also in Sendai throughout the week. So it is a pretty busy week. So that is why I have to apologize that I will quit this telephone earlier after the question and answer session of my presentation. And as Tim kindly introduced, Peace Boat, in cooperation with other civil society organizations, made a booklet in this timing, named 10 Lessons from Fukushima, Reducing Risks and Protecting Communities from Nuclear Disasters. It's about an 80-page booklet, and to be made public online tomorrow, almost 24 hours from now, on the website named fukushimalessons.jp, fukushimalessons.jp. And from this website and the booklet, you can draw a key 10 lessons that we learned, the Japanese people learned from the Fukushima disaster. So let me quickly summarize the key 10 lessons. And these lessons are basically very much community-oriented, how the people's lives and mainly the off-site situation, away from the typical site, the Fukushima Daiichi site, but you know how the residents and the people having problems and learning from the situation. The 10 point is that number one, safety myth. There was very systematic propaganda by the industry and the government that nuclear power is safe, but it was a complete myth. The number two is emergency preparedness plan is necessary, and the basic premise is to run away, because at that time the official direction on evacuation was so disordered. So people have to be prepared that if anything happens, the running away is the basic premise. Number three, access to information and leaving records are vital. This is because lack of comprehensive records at the initial stage mattered a lot in the following years on the survey of health and other investigation. And number four is the need of comprehensive health survey. And as I will talk to you later, but there is an issue of significant increase of thyroid cancer of children of Fukushima. But this survey and evaluation is having very difficult problems in lack of comprehensive monitoring mechanism from the initial stage. And number five is the monitoring system of agricultural and fishery products is necessary, and in particular, the participation of producers and consumers both are very essential. This is a lesson that the government-initiated monitoring system has not enjoyed trust by people. So the participation of the locals are really crucial. Number six is complete decontamination is impossible. And still, the decontamination process in the off-site, the residential area of Fukushima are ongoing, but it is very slow pace, and the waste management of those waste that drew from this contamination works are really problematic, and basically there's no waste management policy. So how to deal with this is a very serious ongoing issue. Number seven is the plant workers' health management, and which is typically in Japan, the most of the workers in this kind of construction site or nuclear power plants are so-called irregular workers under the multi-layered subcontracting system. No proper insurance or workers' rights are provided to those workers. And so there's a serious concerns about how they can be monitored in terms of health and working conditions. And then number eight is rebuilding of daily life and community of people is really important. So this is very important point because, you know, the affected people need not only the money for compensation, but also some sort of community rebuilding or livelihood rebuilding, meaning the keeping the relationship with the family or the community friends and fellows, because they are basically very much people from rural area. So in the displaced places, living separately from the traditional community is really a serious matter for them. So how to rebuild the community is really key issue, but there's no clear established planning for that. And number nine, the laws for rights and relief for those affected must be made with their participation. And actually, 2 years ago, one law named Fukushima Disaster Victim Support Law was made upon. But the implementation process is really far more limited than originally expected. So how to make sure local participation and relief implementation is really crucial. And finally, number 10, is the damage from accidents must be factored into the cost of nuclear power because taxpayers are being made to bear the compensation cost while the operator, TEPCO, is surviving and kind of being rescued from bankrupt. So these 10 lessons were compiled in our idea to share with other countries, of course with the U.S., but at the same time with the countries that plans for nuclear power plants or plans for or increase of nuclear power are existing, like in the Asia Pacific or Middle East. So that is why the civil society groups published this booklet in English and planning to translate this into various other languages to share with Indians and Turkeys and the Middle Eastern and those people. So that is why we are organizing that kind of events in the coming week. And from among these lessons, let me highlight a few problems which is a really particular problem for people. And the number one is about health issue. And as of February this year, out of 380,000 people examined, those who were under 18 years old at the time of accident, 117 people were diagnosed with confirmed or suspected thyroid cancer, which is a really significant number. But the local government explains that this is screening effects, because of this screening effects, and there is no causal relationship between the radiation and this increase of the thyroid cancer. But however, increasing number of independent experts are raising questions on this and asking for more thorough examination and systematic follow-up. And so this is becoming a very much high contentious issue in Japan. So at the same time, not only such examining, but also the prepared treatment and also care, both medical and mental care of the children and parents are becoming a very immediate issue. And secondly, the problem of decontamination process and return policy. And the local government is really promoting return policies, saying that, hey, we already passed 4 years, so now it's time to return to the land, you know, or go home. So in a way, they are really rushing to a so-called decontamination and encouraging people to come back. But ironically, this decontamination work has become a major industry of the region, and with this, those contractors that had built nuclear power plants in the past are benefiting from this decontamination work, and this decontamination is providing employment in the region, where the nuclear power plants were the almost only resource for employment. So now, so this decontamination is becoming a major kind of public work. Despite this call for the governments that, hey, decontaminate and return, the people are not so, the people are basically reluctant to do so. So how the things, change from now is really critical. And in relation to that, lastly, the basic issue for Japan is the lack of policy design on how to rebuild people's life. And still, over 120,000 people are in evacuation, and many of them are still living in temporary shelters. And those temporary shelters, already 4 years, in a severe summer time and the winter time, the shelter is becoming deteriorated in its housing, and of course, yes, some money have been provided to the people, but there's no policy of there's no policy design for those displaced, either through forced evacuation or voluntarily, on how to rebuild their own lives. For example, how to provide decent employment, so that their life can be sustainable. So this compensation is not sufficient nor well designed. And still, the operator of plants are surviving, and with the government support. So this very survival of TEPCO, and the fact that the CEO and the executive members of the TEPCO have not been prosecuted are sending very wrong message to other utility companies in Japan that the risk of nuclear disaster will not that serious for them. That will relate to the restarting debate in Japan, which I believe that Eileen Smith will be speaking later. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Akira. And just as a reminder for everyone, if you want to ask a question, just press star 6 on your phone, and then when prompted, press 1 to be added to the Q&A stack. When it is your turn, you will be notified that you are unmuted, and you may ask your question. Because of the large number of participants tonight, please keep your questions as concise as possible and refrain from making long statements. And I believe we have a few people queued up to ask questions now, and so we'll go ahead and start with Scott Portzline.
Hi, this is Scott Portzline, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Three Mile Island Alert. Is there any evidence or suspicion that Unit 4 was being used to process plutonium for nuclear weapons, seeing how the next door unit, number 3, had the MOX fuel?
Akira?
Yeah, can I respond? So, it is a bit surprising and annoying that the use of Unit 3 for this MOX fuel is triggering a concern or suspect that the possible Japan's production of nuclear weapons. But in my understanding, there's no such evidence. In the case of Fukushima, not only in the case of Fukushima Daiichi plant, but also any other nuclear power plants, especially with the MOX plan for such nuclear ambition. I understand that there are increasing international concern regarding the huge and increasing stockpile of plutonium in the form of MOX fuel, and also the other spirit plutonium in the Rokkasho nuclear reprocessing plant. But and this is a serious concern, but in my understanding, there's no direct and immediate plan of nuclear weapons production in Japan.
Okay, then we'll move on to our next question.
There's over 1,000 storage tanks in Fukushima with radioactive water. How many tons of water are escaping from those tanks each day?
Can I respond? So it is said that every day 4,000 tons of water not leaked from the tanks, but
that's proceeding from underneath the reactor site.
So those water is coming to the reactor, so being contaminated and to be stored and other form. And there's a report regarding the leakage from those tanks, but it's not that big order, like hundreds or 1,000 tons. There's some cases of such reports exist, but I don't think there's any comprehensive data disclosure from TEPCO, because this site is very much off the limit place, so there's no, how to say, reliable, comprehensive monitoring on the situation of the tanks.
Great. And moving on to the next question.
Hello, this is Melly Stokesberry in Maui, Hawaii. Many people from Hawaii, including children, travel to Japan, and of course we're very concerned about the people there. How much do you think the people who are not in Fukushima, but say a radius of 100 miles or farther out, are in danger of inhaling or consuming radioactive material, harming their health?
Thanks. Yeah, very good point. And, you know, Fukushima is the name of a prefecture, administration area, which is artificially, you know, bordered. And there are many other surrounding prefectures like Tochigi, Chiba, Miyagi, and those areas. And how the radioactive plume spread, and or how those radioactive materials spread in the time, is now being kind of disclosed in the form of the contamination map, which you can see online in many places, including in the booklet that I refer to. But it shows at least four or five prefectures have been contaminated very significantly. But ironically, the Fukushima prefecture, Fukushima prefecture is a kind of mandated and also budgeted by the government to do the health checkup and the monitoring of the, for example, the thyroid cancer rate, which I reported, was based on the kind of official prefectural health management survey. But in the surrounding prefectures, those are not budgeted and mandated. So there's no way to check and investigate how much degree of thyroid cancer increase or any other health issues exist in the area. And I understand that the people are trying to go to hospitals, clinics on an independent basis, but very much it's ad hoc, simultaneous efforts by individuals. So it's really so the civil society is trying to convince the government, the central government, to take care of those comprehensive checkup, regardless of the difference of the prefectures. But there's no sign so far that the central government goes on to that direction.
Okay, we have several more questions, so I'm going to put in as many as we can while we still got you, Akira.
Yes, Dave Schlesinger here from near Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm just checking to see whether you or anyone has looked into the possibility that the U.S. government, through its High-Frequency Active Oral Research Program, also known as HARP, could have caused the ocean disturbance which created the catastrophe.
Oh, it's difficult for me to answer
like
that question. It's difficult for me to answer to this question. I have no idea on that.
Okay. Well, we'll move on to the next one.
Hi, this is Michelle Lee of the Indian Point Safe Energy Coalition in New York. Thanks so much for your presentation. The UN had initially indicated about 150,000 people were evacuated. Is there a precise record of how many people are still displaced? And also, is there any kind of record of what percentage of the people still displaced are families with school-age children?
Well, for the second question, I don't see. I've never seen such a survey about this school and the ratio of those families with the school-age children. But for the total number of evacuees in regards to the in regards to Fukushima, is the latest number I have is the as of September 2014. The official number from the government, central government, is 126,327 evacuees from Fukushima Prefecture, either to other prefectures or within Fukushima Prefecture. That, so that's the, official number.
Okay, and going on to our next question.
Hi, this is Judith Lomas. I'm in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm a member of Nuclear Watch South, and we are one of the first permitted new reactors to be built in the U.S. We've got two reactors being built in Augusta. So we're very concerned about this process, but very encouraged to hear that decontamination is an employer. But here's my question. On the 11th, we're going to go to the Japanese consulate. We have a pretty good relationship with the consul there, and we wonder what message should we convey to the consul here that will get back to the government in Japan that the American people are watching for this most important thing. Because last year the consul said to us, well, I don't really know very much about energy matters, which, you know, I suppose was just a polite way of avoiding saying something. But what should we try to tell the consul general here that will get back to the government in Japan that the American people are concerned with the Japanese people about this most important thing?
Okay, thank you very much. Very good question. I think, for example, by pointing out the reports of this thyroid cancer increase, you know, to let them know that people in the U.S. and around the world are aware of the fact that that the affected people are not properly treated, and there are so many issues like health management and workers' health issues and many other, you know, untouched issue, unsolved issue exists. That recognition should be clearly, you know, presented to them, because I think I can imagine those government people out of Japan would automatically tell, thank you for very much for taking care of this situation, but the situation is under control and the people are, of course, in a severe situation, but the rebuilding process is going on. So thank you for taking care of them. You know, that kind of general, you know, greeting will be very much expected. So I think the health management, both residents and workers, and also, you know, as discussed, you know, the leaking water problem, those issues are very much the information is very much closed, not disclosed, right? So those concerns should be transmitted, and more information disclosure, and also proper treatment for the residents and workers should be good point in talking to them.
Great. Well, Akira, thank you so much for joining us. I think we only have time for one more question on your presentation, and I know that you need to get going as well. So we'll have one more question, and then we'll move on to Eileen Miyoko-Smith's presentation.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. I'm Carolyn Treadway from Washington State, and I have a double question. My first question is, how did the radiation that was lost out of the reactors, how did that compare to Chernobyl? The other part of my question is, I am just back from Fukushima. I was there in November traveling in Fukushima, Ken, and a couple of other provinces. And in so many areas, they were scraping irradiated earth and trimming trees and so on to quote, decontaminate, unquote. And to me, it was heartrending because the next rain or snow will bring the radiation down from the mountains, which haven't been, quote, cleaned, unquote. And it just seems so heartbreakingly futile. So how safe is it? I know it varies place to place. How safe is it, even after it's decontaminated, for people to actually be there? And how does that compare with Chernobyl?
It's a great question, Carolyn.
Yeah, well, I'm not a scientist nor a medical expert, but I cannot properly answer. And there should be many literatures regarding the amount, quantity of the radioactive materials that were dispersed from the Daiichi plant, and all. Ongoing research being conducted. For example, recently, Japanese public television, NHK, did a very good program about assessment of the amount of the radioactive materials and the process of the disperse very scientifically and critically, and which shows that it indicated it would be much bigger and larger and more complicated than originally anticipated. So having said all this, my general understanding is that the total amount of radioactive material that was dispersed from the Daiichi plant is about between 1/5 to 1/10 of the amount that was dispersed from the Chernobyl reactor. And so then effects of this radiation. So I can't, speak in a scientific sense, but it is a very much a matter of dispute and debate. How basically those radiation is so-called low dose radiation. So how to assess the long-term low dose radiation and its health impact? Is the views are really widely debated, so now the official government line of explanation is that now that all the radiations in the residential area and also the forest area of Fukushima and around Fukushima, less than significant amount to cause any health impact. But many independent researchers and experts warning that it is not accurate to dismiss the impact of low dose radiation. And so, that's all what I can tell.
Well, thank you, Akira, and thank you again so much for producing this wonderful booklet outlining the concerns that people should be aware of with respect to nuclear accidents. And thank you so much for your work, and we hope to have you back again soon.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Okay, well, so we'll move on to our next presentation, and it looks like one of our presenters, Eileen Miyoko-Smith, might be having some trouble accessing the telephone line. So I think if possible, we'd like to move on to David Lockbaum's presentation next. David, are you there?
Yes, I am, Tim. Thank you.
Okay, great. Sorry to put you on the spot like this. I'll give you a minute to prepare just, by way of introduction.
No problem at all.
So next, as I mentioned, we'll be hearing from David Lockbaum, the nuclear safety engineer for the Union of Concerned Scientists. David is one of the foremost experts on nuclear reactors and safety regulations in the United States and has been an indispensable resource in helping ordinary people understand what are often highly technical issues. He led a heroic effort in the days, weeks, and months after the nuclear accidents in Fukushima started, providing daily updates to reporters, activists, and the general public to provide as much clarity as possible about what was actually happening and what the risks were. Last year, with his colleague Ed Lyman at UCS and investigative journalist Susan Stranahan, he published the first full account of the accidents titled Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster. Tonight, he is going to discuss one of the ways in which nuclear safety regulators in the U.S. have failed to change the way they do business in light of the TEPCO accidents in Fukushima through what he calls risk-deformed regulation. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tim, and thanks, everybody, for dialing into this important topic. I want to talk a little bit tonight about atomic speedometers, and I'll get to what that means in just a second. The U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission did look at the accident at Fukushima and tried to develop lessons extractable from that accident that, if implemented here, would reduce the vulnerability of U.S. reactors to an American Fukushima. All told, they come up with about 36 recommendations that were not all the same weight, weren't all the same importance. So the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the nuclear industry almost immediately began looking at how to triage that list so as to purportedly do the most important safety upgrades first and do the lesser important upgrades later. That was basically nuke speak for which ones are going to get dropped onto the floor. To explain that gobbledygook, the methods that are used to define what's risk, what's high risk, and what's lower risk, I want to use the analogy of the speed limits. Local, state, and federal officials will post limits on how fast people can drive their vehicles along roads under normal conditions. The posted speed limits vary from road to road and area to area, and can be better. There's less interference, less distractions, and they're lower when in school zones, hospital zones, and congested areas. In order to allow drivers to get some sense of whether they're meeting the posted speed limits or not, vehicles are equipped with speedometers that measure speed and allow drivers to compare how they're doing against what the posted speed limits indicate. Similarly, law enforcement officers have radar guns that allow them to look and check how fast a car going by is traveling compared to what the posted speed limits are. So they don't have to count Mississippi's and then figure out what the speed limit is. They have a little radar gun that tells them what the speed limit is. And when the radar gun shows that a vehicle is traveling faster than the posted speed limit, that driver can expect to receive a traffic ticket or shouldn't be surprised if that's the case. There's a similar system that's applied to nuclear power plant safety. In the mid-1980s, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission adopted safety goals for the operation of nuclear power plants. The NRC developed two subsidiary goals. One was that to limit the core damage frequency, the chance of something leading to a core meltdown, of less than 1 E⁻⁻⁰ per reactor year. And the second goal was the large early release frequency, the chances that a large radioactive cloud goes drifting away from a nuclear power plant, to be less than 1 E⁻⁶ per reactor year. Tim mentioned the gobbledygook earlier, and that's definitely.
Hey, David, it sounds like your signal is cutting in and out a little bit. Are you having any trouble with your phone? Okay, sorry. It looks like David's telephone number failed. He'll be calling back in just a second. So let's see. Do we have Eileen Miyoka Smith on the line? Sorry, everyone. Thanks for your patience. We're just having a little bit of technical difficulty with a couple of our presenters. Really appreciate your patience. We're waiting for Dave Lockbaum to call back in. And I imagine he'll be back. Oh, here he is. David, is that you? Sorry, thanks everybody, and thanks for your patience. We're just waiting for David Lockbaum to call back in. He should be on in just a second. But I think while we're waiting for David to call back in, I think one of the points that was talked about during Akira Kawasaki's presentation was about the status of the contaminated water storage at Fukushima. And one of the important details that's been talked about some in the media this week is about the possibility that the Japanese government is going to authorize the discharges of these of the contaminated water that's being stored in tanks at the site right now to begin to discharge that into the ocean. And this is a really contentious and complicated question because on the one hand, one of the ways in which TEPCO and the Japanese government have been trying to minimize the amount of contamination entering the ocean from the site has been to filter water that they can pump out of the reactor buildings and underground and filter that and then store the water that's still contaminated after filtering in what's now about 1,000 very large tanks. And right now there's basically almost no room left at the Fukushima site to put in more of these large tanks. And so the government is considering whether to allow the discharge of this water into the ocean. We consider this, a really serious question about, the future health of the ocean in the area, and one which people really need to pay attention to. One of the additional concerns this has raised, and this is something that TEPCO, the utility, is raising, is that the workers are, if they continue to have to manage these large tanks, that the workers are going to be so consumed with just having to manage the tanks that there's going to be very little manpower left to do the rest of the decommissioning and, work at the site. So this is, an ongoing dimension to the crisis that's very serious, and especially with the issue that Akira raised about the limited availability of skilled workers who are experienced in working with radioactive materials and nuclear sites to be able to manage the facility going forward. So it looks like David has not called back in. I think, we could probably try to answer some questions or open some of these questions up for discussion if people would like to do that. There's certainly a lot to discuss. If you would like to ask a question or to kickstart a discussion, please press *6 on your phone. That'll prompt you to press 1 if you want to be added to the queue. And I see a few people are doing that. So why don't we go ahead and start with that, and then we'll get some dialogue going. Hi, what's your question?
Hello. Yes, this is Kevin Camps with Beyond Nuclear, and I just wanted to follow up, Tim, on that issue you just raised, and Akira spoke about the radioactive water discharges to the ocean. I heard the figure from Akira, I believe it was Akira, in his answer of 4,000 tons per day, and I'd never heard a figure that high. I had heard a figure more like 400 tons per day or 500 tons per day.
Yeah, I think that was just a slip on his part. I think it's actually, at this time last year, it was estimated at 400 tons per day. And I think because of the work that TEPCO has done this year, it's actually been reduced somewhat. The figure that I saw reported this week was 300 tons per day, that they've managed to reduce some of the amount of water that's contaminated water that's leaking into the ocean.
Yeah, so that figure you just pointed out, 300 tons per day of contaminated groundwater flowing into the ocean on a daily basis. That would be in addition to probably another 400 tons of water per day, which they are able to capture, that's used for cooling of the 3 melted down reactor cores. And that's what's going into that storage tank farm that's growing by leaps and bounds. And I guess one verification of that figure would be that every 2 or 3 days they have to add another 1,000-ton tank to the growing tank farm.
That's right. I think I saw it described that it was essentially the equivalent of, over 700, 25-meter swimming pools that are being stored in these huge water tanks at the site.
And I guess the last thing I'll say is just how shameful it is that people like Lake Barrett, formerly of the Department of Energy's Yucca Mountain project. To the best of my understanding, is still a paid consultant for TEPCO, as is Dale Klein, the former NRC chairman. And I've seen at least Lake Barrett quoted in the Japanese press really urging that the accumulated, what is it now, 300,000 tons of contaminated water, supposedly once certain radionuclides are filtered out, that it then be released to the ocean. And I know of no technology, although I've heard some talk about the tritium in that water. I don't think it's filterable, but there are some claims apparently that it is possible, but I've seen media coverage that they don't plan to filter the tritium before release.
Yeah, that's right. I've heard the same thing. And I think maybe we have David Lockbaum back on the line. Is that true? David, are you there? Okay. I guess we'll continue with some more questions. Kevin, thank you for raising that. That's a really good point. Hello?
Hi, this is Judith Lomas again with Nuke Watch South in Atlanta, Georgia.
Hi, Judith.
I am following the suit by the USS Reagan sailors and thinking that everybody on the West Coast would be members of a class action to get some kind of an injunction to keep TEPCO from discharging the radioactive water into the Pacific. So I'm wondering if NIRS has considered bringing a suit to bring this matter to international attention, and what forum would that suit be brought?
You mean with respect to the sailors or with respect to Japanese citizens?
Not only Japanese citizens, but U.S. citizens on the West Coast. If they start dumping radioactive water contaminated with tritium, you know, into the Pacific, they're basically, it's like dumping poison on somebody's lawn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a trespass. And I'm looking at, you know, there has NIRS considered any kind of a suit in an international forum?
We haven't. It's an interesting idea. I would imagine that it would concern, you know, pretty much every nation in the Pacific Basin if they were to do that. I'm not sure that we're the best equipped to mount a lawsuit ourselves, but I think it's certainly an interesting idea, you know, in terms of, you know, in that direction that international advocacy could take. I think there is a practical consideration of how they actually, how TEPCO and the Japanese government are going to be able to continue managing this water storage problem. I mean, obviously dumping it wholesale into the ocean is not acceptable, but there's a really practical concern about how they actually are going to continue to, you know, to manage the processing of all of this contaminated water. It's you know, in some ways, a really, you know, difficult question to figure out. One of the other possibilities would be for them to have to continue building storage tanks, but off-site, and then have to pipe water.
Am I mute?
No, you're unmuted.
Oh, okay. Because what I would think is that this would be a way to bring TEPCO down, to actually, you know, bankrupt them rather than keeping them solvent, would be for an international forum to force them to bear the expense. I mean, I know our engineers would happily come up with some way of, you know, continuing the storage with tanks, but not at the taxpayer's expense, at TEPCO's expense. It just would seem to me a way to get that accomplished.
Yeah, there's a question is, you know, whether bankrupting TEPCO is actually going to help the problem. In some ways, if TEPCO goes bankrupt, then the taxpayers are going to end up having to pay for it anyway, because, you know, the job still has to get done.
Well, I guess what Mr. Kurosaka was saying was, you know, none of the TEPCO people have been criminally prosecuted.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that individual executives could be held personally liable in an international action, a civil action, for the expense of this.
Yeah, no, I mean, definitely the issue of liability and, you know, responsibility for, you know, for what took place is really important. And certainly, you know, the fact that nobody has been prosecuted is, you know, is totally unacceptable. I think we have David Lochbaum and Eileen Miyoko-Smith on the line now. Let me see if I can find them. David Lochbaum and Eileen, could you raise your hands to talk? Just press star six. Oh, great, David, you're there. Would you like to continue your presentation?
Yeah, sorry for that. It just dropped out. I was mentioning that the speedometers in cars and radar guns allow drivers and local law enforcement to see whether posted speed limits are being met. The risks at nuclear power plants can't be measured that way. You can't weigh them. You can't use a yardstick to measure them. So instead, plant owners estimate or calculate the risk, and likewise, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission estimates and calculates the risk. Plant owners developed what are called probabilistic risk assessments, or PRAs, which are also sometimes called probabilistic safety studies, that calculate the chances of core meltdown for their reactors. Similarly, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission developed what it calls standardized plant analysis risk, or SPAR, SPAR models, that also calculate the core damage frequency or the chances of meltdown. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission also expended considerable effort and resources to understand the differences between the PRA and the SPAR model results for individual reactors, and when appropriate, made adjustments to narrow those differences. So the SPAR model is essentially like radar guns that allow the NRC to measure the risk at a plant versus their safety goal. I went back and reviewed the risk calculated by the plant owners and by the NRC for significant nuclear safety violations identified since the reactor oversight process was adopted by the NRC in the year 2000. The reactor oversight process characterizes the risk significance of safety violations using four color codes, green, white, yellow, and red, in order of increasing risk. Basically, I went back and examined the yellow and red findings issued by the NRC since the year 2000. The closest agreement between what the plan owner calculated the risk to be and what the NRC calculated that risk to be occurred at Oconee for a violation involving its standby shutdown facility. The NRC's calculated risk was only twice as high as the plan owner's calculated risk, and that was the closest one. The widest gap between what the owner thought the risk was and what the NRC thought the risk was involved flooding protection violations at Watts Bar. The NRC's calculated risk was merely 800 times higher than the plant owner's calculated risk. So the atomic speedometers and the nuclear radar guns are not well calibrated, or they're examining two entirely different things. To put this risk ciphering gap into perspective, I adjusted the numbers to account for the differences, but in terms of speeds, like you would on a speedometer. I zeroed all the risks that the owners calculated to be equivalent to 55 miles per hour, a typical speed limit. The Oconee issue, again, was the closest one. Its owner thought the risk was equivalent to 55 miles per hour, where the NRC's radar gun clocked it at 110 miles per hour. Ealing Point Unit 2 had a steam generator tube leak back in February 2000, whereas its owner thought it was 55 miles per hour. The NRC's radar gun was merely 238 miles per hour. Browns Ferry had a problem with a valve on a cooling water system. It thought it was 40 miles per hour. Arkansas Nuclear One had a problem in March of 2013 where they dropped a heavy load, killed a worker, injured some others. The owner thought that was calculated at 55 miles per hour. The NRC clocked that at 688 miles per hour. Fort Calhoun in Nebraska had some problems with flooding back in the year 2000. When its owner thought it was 55 miles per hour, the NRC's calculation was merely 2,095 miles per hour. And at the bottom of the list is the Watts Bar and its flooding issue, where the owner thought it was 55 miles per hour, and the NRC calculated a whopping 42,853 miles per hour. The problem is if the difference between speedometers and radar guns in the real world were such a wide gap, the whole game of speedometers, posted speed limit signs, and radar guns would be entirely useless, because you're not measuring the things you're trying to control, speed limits, and then the risk associated with cars traveling at that speed couldn't be measured by the driver and the cops on the same page. They're not even in the same book, let alone on the same page. So when owners and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission can't see within a factor of 2 to a factor of 800 of the same risk, it's sheer folly to then try to look at determining what you're going to do based on the risk significance, because they're simply not measuring the same things in the same ways. And I'm not even going to vote on which one is right. When they're that different, you can't reliably measure and monitor and manage risks, because you're simply guessing, and the guesses aren't real close. So just last Thursday, UCS wrote a letter to the chairman and the commissioners pointing out these gaps and saying they need to direct their staff to figure out why people looking at the same issue using the same calculators and the same math come up with entirely different answers. And then to ask why, since they don't see eye to eye and are so far apart, why are you proceeding down a risk-informed pathway? Because as Tim indicated, it's not risk-informed, it's risk-deformed. When you're just so far apart, it doesn't matter who's right or who's wrong. If you're trying to manage risk and you can't come any closer than that to agreeing on what the risks are, then you shouldn't be in the risk management business, or you've got to get yourself another tool, because that one is simply not working. So we'll see. It'll be kind of interesting to see what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission does. If they proceed essentially blind to what the risks are, or whether they'll try to work with the industry to come up with speedometers and radar guns that are actually somewhat close to agreeing on what the underlying risks are. Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much, David, and thanks for bearing with us through the technical issues. We do have a few questions, and maybe it would just be best to jump in right away.
Okay. Okay.
Great. Caller, you can ask your question.
Hello. This is Lucy Marie Ruth from California. I shudder to think about the implications of calculating the inherent risk of human error in running nuclear power plants. But my question is really about reactor design and where you place them. Has the NRC done anything about saying that it's a bad idea to build reactors and to leave reactors that are currently in operation, to leaving them active and not decommissioning them if they're on earthquake fault lines? I mean, this is an obvious question that comes up from Fukushima.
Yeah, we issued a report working with a group in California, and the report was called Seismic Shift back in November of 2013. Diablo Canyon is yards away from a fault line, and the estimates are that the ground motion from an earthquake on that fault line could be greater than the plant is designed to withstand. Our reports show that every time the NRC faced that question in the past, they did not allow the nuclear facility to operate until that problem was fixed. But Diablo Canyon, to make an exception, they're allowing it to run.
Well, maybe they shouldn't.
Yeah. If they followed what they've done in the past, they would not allow that plant to run in an unsafe condition, but they're gambling.
Yeah.
Did I drop off?
Oops, I got cut off or something.
Hello? Sorry, we had another technical problem on the back end. David, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. I'm sorry that we got cut off like that.
Is there another question?
There is. Let me see. Next question.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, this is April Schiller. I'm in Connecticut, and I just had a question of, like, whether you guys are doing anything, like at your organization, the Nuclear Information Resource, whatever, or if you know of anybody that's, like, because down here in New England, they're proposing a gas pipeline expansion from Spectra Energy, and it's called the AIM Project.
Uh-huh.
But it's going to have like a 42-inch diameter pipeline, like a high-pressure pipeline carrying fracked natural gas.
Uh-huh.
And it says it's supposed to, I'll just read the thing. It says it's supposed to intersect two proposed mega-voltage power lines just a few hundred feet from Indian Point Nuclear Power Plant and 40 years of spent nuclear fuel rods near the Ramapo and Stamford faults.
Uh-huh.
And I looked up online, and Indian Point's supposed to be like I think like 25 miles from New York City or something. So I mean, I'm just kind of like really, I know that sometimes the fracked gas and the coal people and the nuke people and everybody, they're all kind of like in their separate activism camps sometimes, but it's something that really concerns me, because when Fukushima happened, it was set off by like a tsunami, but a natural gas explosion that close to a nuclear plant, that close to such a very populated area, I mean, that sounds kind of like the kind of disaster that you expect to encounter in the movie theater and not in real life. So.
Sure. So yeah, I mean, I can address this quickly. It's you know, and it is, you know, in some ways relevant to the discussion that that David is leading here. There is a proposal to put a large high pressure natural gas pipeline directly through the Indian Point reactor site, which, as you mentioned, is, you know, within a mile or two of the intersection of two active fault lines. Indian Point 3 is rated as the most vulnerable reactor in the country to a nuclear accident as a result of an earthquake. You know, I think to the caller's question about the advocacy, you know, around the various issues that are involved in this, I think I can say confidently with respect to this issue that the people that are, you know, the anti-fracking activists and, you know, the anti-fossil fuel activists and the anti-nuclear activists are very much all working along the same lines, you know, both to ensure that Indian Point is closed down, but also, you know, that this natural gas infrastructure project does not move forward either. So I think, you know, with that, you know, I might hand it back to Dave to see if, you know, if you've got anything to add on that particular point.
Well, I think one thing I could add would be that the Paul Blanch in Connecticut identified that concerns with that issue. And he's been working with Senator Schumer's office, Assemblywoman Senator Gillis' office, and many other local officials in the state of New York to try to question FERC and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission on the sanity of that configuration. I think it's still a work in progress. There have been some gains, there have been some setbacks, but I think on the plus side, there's a lot of elected officials who are questioning whether this is a good idea or not, and it remains to be seen whether that proposal gets implemented.
Great. So we'll move on to the next question. Hi, you should be unmuted.
Yes. This is Joe DeMar. I'm with Unplugged Nuclear Power. And one of the big things about risk assessment that we brought up during the Davis-Bessey relicensing is that the risk projections that the NRC has had don't match up with real-world experiences. For example, they calculate the risk of a control room flooding for a nuclear power plant. That's something like once every 10,000 years. And, of course, it's already happened. And, you know, many other possible disasters that they calculate out as it being 100,000 or, you know, 10,000 years away have already happened. Is there any chance of getting the NRC to work real numbers back into their risk assessment, or are they just so committed to their fantasy that there's no point in trying?
That's a good point, John. We've raised, and many others, Arne Gunnarsson and others have raised that issue. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission's rebuttal or counterpoint is that they can't use numbers from the past because those were learning opportunities. The lessons were learned, improvements were made, so it's not apples and oranges. It's unfair to use those old numbers. So they'll use the numbers when they're good, and they'll reject the numbers if they're bad. By that same logic, I'd have been a straight-A student because all the wrong answers on my tests would have been tossed out. But you can look at my transcript and see that my professors didn't go with that.
Great. Hello? And going to the next question.
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah. David Gettert, Buffalo, New York. Big fan of Dave Lockbaum. I have your book in my library downstairs. Okay, World Science Fiction Convention 2007 with Yokohama, Japan. Loved it. Had a great time. Then got back to Japan on vacation 2011. Right now, we're looking for the site for the World Science Fiction Convention 2017. There is some activity in favor of Tokyo, Chiba, somewhere in that area. Helsinki, Finland is putting on another bid, another strong bid. As much as I love the islands and the people, how great an idea is it having a major convention in, as I said, the Tokyo, Chiba area?
To be honest, I don't know enough about that to rate how good or bad an idea it is. I just don't know enough background.
How do we look into that? You know, like what are the radiation levels? Say you're going to be in that part of Japan for a week, 2 weeks. How would you find out what radiation level you would be exposed to, and would there be any concern with it?
Let me ask my colleague Ed Lemon, who does more of our off-site dose calculations, and I'll, if you email me or contact me, I'll get the answer from Ed, who does our off-site dose calculations, and get back to you.
Now, who is this I'm talking with?
This is Dave Lockbaum.
Okay, I'll get you from your website. Yeah, the fishing stories.
Email address is just D Lockbaum, DLOCHBAUM, at UCSUSA.org.
ECUS.org.
UCSUSA.org.
Yep. Give me the letters again, please. I'm
It's ECSUSA.org.
Excuse me, I'm a voice broker.
ECSUSA. Concerned Scientist USA. Okay, I got it now. Thank you very much.
Sorry, Dave, we've been getting a little static
Hello?
On your line.
So,
sometimes I think some of the letters got garbled.
She's on.
Okay. Great. Okay. Well, I think we actually have Eileen Miyoko Smith on the line right now, and I think in the interest of being able to get to her presentation before the 9:30 hour, let's hold other additional questions. And Dave, thank you so much for your presentation tonight, and I hope you can stick around in case there are some more questions that might apply to your area of expertise.
I will. Mm-hmm.
Great. So Eileen, I'm glad that we were finally able to work out the technical bugs here, and thank you so much for your patience and for taking the effort to be on the call tonight.
Thank you, and I've heard most of what's been going on and the questions. and I'm really happy to join. Thank you. A couple of things. One question that was just asked about the contamination levels in the greater Tokyo area. A radiation-controlled area, in other words, for example, in a hospital where you work inside and there's radiation, when you leave, you have to make sure you're decontaminated. That's 40,000 becquerels per square meter. And there's swathes of several prefectures in Japan that are between 30 and 60,000 becquerels. So that would be northern part of Tochigi and Gunma, also Ibaraki, parts of Tokyo, Saitama. It's a difficult question when people are concerned about, you know, we're coming for a few days or a couple weeks. Should we be concerned? I think each person has to decide. You just have to be aware about what levels are where. Not all of Tokyo is this level between 30 and 60,000, but there are parts, but they are more on the outskirts, the parts of Chiba, et cetera. And so that has to be examined. And I think the most important thing, if you go to Japanese consulates, is for them to tell you the accurate information so that each person can assess according to what they feel is safe or not safe. I think that's the best answer. I would like to say that if you're there for a short period, that's far less exposure than, you know, the issue of living there. So that's important to take in mind. I want to address what we're trying to do to stop, prevent another Fukushima in Japan, which, you know, the end of the story is still not here. This is a country prone to earthquakes and volcanoes. And I think that just, for example, Indian Point was mentioned, and a lot of what I would like to say is it relates to areas such as the greater New York area and California, because there are earthquake issues there in the U.S. too. We have still 48 operating nuclear power plants in Japan and other nuclear facilities. This is an advanced-based lesson in California. But importantly, there have been zero nuclear power plants operating for the last year and a half in Japan. So we don't have a single light bulb lit up by nuclear power in Japan. And we've had no blackouts. And yet the Abe government has its head in its sand because it declared middle of last year that nuclear power was an important base load source of electricity for Japan. And so it needs a reality check. But the nuclear industry and utilities and the government are trying to restart reactors. There are 20 reactor restart applications in currently. And citizens and all over Japan and the national lawyers teams we have lawsuits against every single reactor in Japan. Trying to keep them shut. And we had an epoch-making decision last May. The Oi plant in central Japan, facing the Japan Sea, the verdict of the district court said that it considers the national wealth to be the rich land and the people's livelihood that have taken root there, and that being unable to recover these is the true loss of national wealth. And the court also said that anybody within 250 kilometers so that would be about 160 miles. Let's see, that was 1.6 miles to a kilometer. Anyway, so huge swathes of land would have the right to sue, because that was the area that Prime Minister Kan Naoto had to consider for evacuation. That would have been large chunks of Tokyo if and when the Fukushima accident got worse. So we've had these victory wins, but then now the utility is appealing the decision. So far right now, the Nuclear Regulatory Authority, or NRA, Nuclear Regulation Authority of Japan, has spent a lot more time trying to restart nuclear power in Japan rather than working on the Fukushima site. And initially, there's been initial approval for 4 reactor restarts, and we're fighting to stop that from happening. They're in 2 locations in Japan, 2 reactors in southern Japan, where there are 5 super volcano rings within 100 miles of the reactor. It's the Sendai Unit 1 and 2. The people in that area are really vocal and are really trying to prevent restart. For example, cities nearby, they've gotten signatures of half the population demanding that unless there's a really good evacuation plan, you shouldn't restart the plants. And then the other site is in Takahama on Wakasa Bay that's facing the Japan Sea. It's a location where there are 15 reactors, and we're trying to stop the Takahama units 3 and 4 from restarting. That would be the start of restarts, and we're trying to prevent that. A really well-known seismologist who first coined the word Genpatsu Shinsai, which means a nuclear disaster as a result of an earthquake, he had said that this area is next to Hamaoka, which is near Tokyo. It's a very dangerous nuclear power plant, you know, earthquake fault site. Other than that, this Wakasa Bay area is the second is the most dangerous earthquake-wise. So we're trying to prevent restarts in this area in order to prevent another Fukushima from happening. The majority of citizens in Japan are still opposed to nuclear power, or they want to phase out nuclear power. Their last polls, for example, 84% of the population want phase out. And there's a good chunk of people who don't want any reactors to restart. The problem is that the Nuclear Regulation Authority, the NRA, doesn't follow its own regulations and guidelines. For example, with the volcano issue in southern Japan, the NRA guide requires that these calderas, these super volcano eruptions, be monitored, and it should be able to predict what will be happening, and that nuclear fuel, all of it from the site, has to be removed before any huge volcano events. Well, that's the regulation that the NRA created, the guideline, but the utility is not following that guideline, but yet they approved the main initial restart review. So that's a problem. And the other is that the Japanese NRA volcano guide is much weaker than the IAEA guide. And that has to be pointed out because Prime Minister Abe is saying that Japan has the highest nuclear regulation standards in the world or is aiming for it, and that's far from true. There are other major issues that the NRA is not dealing with. I want to move on to a couple of other issues. One is that a multi-partisan diet group, Genpatsu Zero no Kai, which is made up of 64 national diet members from 8 political parties, and they're saying like 28 of these reactors in Japan have to be shut down immediately because they were already damaged by the 3/11 earthquake, and also they have very serious foundation problems, you know, underground like earthquake fault lines. So, you know, the number of reactors you have to work with that could restart is just really few in number. And for example, in my central Kyoto region of Kansai, 7 of the 11 reactors of Kansai Electric, the second largest utility owns, is already 30 years old. As of a couple months, the seventh one will be that old. So you already have really just Japanese reactor fleet is aging, but the 10 electric utilities have already spent over $20 billion for construction work to address safety measures. So you're spending a lot of money on these pretty old, you know, aging or starting to age, not new reactors. And is that really, economically advisable as well as the safety issue? And then lastly, I know I only have a few minutes left, the evacuation issue, because this relates really to the U.S. also, like especially New York City, lots of areas in the U.S., about evacuation. We have 5 million people living within a 19-mile radius of our nuclear power plant total. And in my region, which is Kyoto, the Kansai area, that's where Takahama is. Anyway, 13 towns and cities have to evacuate to a total of 83 towns and cities. And citizens have been to dozens of these towns to figure out what's happening with the evacuation. There's no really total lack of preparedness. And for example, in Kyoto Prefecture, 128,000 people have to evacuate. And they evacuate south to, for example, Kyoto City. But simulations show that Kyoto City would have to face indoor evacuation, perhaps in a serious accident, or a large swathes of land towards Kobe where people are evacuating. The levels would be too high that those cities would actually have to be evacuating, or they might have to be taking potassium iodide pills. So this evacuation issue is just incredible and impossible to do. And the Union of Kansai Governments has demanded that we're not in any environment to restart unless our cities, in other words, far away from the reactors, but still the citizens are going to be affected. So they should have the same rights as the areas where the plants are located. And there should be a legal framework to protect citizens and financial framework. That means millions and millions of people. And one thing that was really significant is, for example, we put up on our website, the Green Action Japan website, Japan Times English newspaper article about World Heritage sites being at the mercy of these Fukui nuclear power plants, the ones I just told you about, you know, Takahama and the in Wakasa Bay. And we put that up on our Facebook site, and then 3 days later I looked and there's 40,000 hits. You know, people worldwide are concerned about Kyoto and protecting Kyoto. It's a World Heritage Site. And the Buddhist monks, very prominent people, are very concerned. And if you're interested in going to the Japanese consulate, I would say that, you know, people all over the world, you know, love Kyoto and its World Heritage. And, you know, protecting the children and citizens from another nuclear disaster is primary, and the environment, but also the culture of Japan. And I think if you could address that, that would be great leverage for us here. And the earthquake issue and the evacuation issue, especially the evacuation issue, I think is very significant for all of you in the U.S. too. So I think that, you know, really looking at evacuation, Yasuko, former director of NRC, spoke recently here, you know, about, you know, the issue about if you have to evacuate people, that's not really a safe nuclear problem. And that needs to be addressed. I hope I made some sense in my short cramped time I spoke, but if there are any questions, I guess we only have about 3 minutes left.
Yeah, well, Eileen, this is Tim. I think we'll extend a few extra minutes so that we can get in some questions, and you know, and you know, for hope for anybody who's interested can stay on for, you know, for maybe another 10 minutes or so. You know, I think we're already getting some questions for you. As a reminder to everybody, if you'd like to ask a question, please press *6, and then you'll be prompted to press 1, and then you'll be put in the queue. I think we've got probably time for 3 or 4 questions. So why don't we go ahead and jump in with the folks that are putting themselves in the queue now. All right, please ask your question.
Hello, I'm Carolyn Treadway again. I've read Arne Gundersen's plea for the best minds and skilled people of the world to come together to help resolve as best possible the Fukushima disaster. And I'm wondering, is there any hope that this can happen, and what can we as individual private citizens do to get other people there? TEPCO can't handle this, and Japan can't handle this by themselves.
Yes, that's really important. And, you know, again, addressing going to the Japanese consulates, but it should be public where you have told people, the media, other people, that you have gone to the consulates, Japanese consulates, and that is to say that this is an international issue. It should be addressed internationally. The lessons to be learned from Chernobyl is that, you know, there has to be good research done immediately and also measures being undertaken. So there should be international expertise. So the expertise of the world should be here and make that very public and tell the Japanese government it's not, it shouldn't be considered sort of like a loss of pride. It should be an international project. And the other that has to be done is researching the environment. For example, Dr. Tim Musso of University of North Carolina has been doing excellent research, that kind of research about what is affecting the environment, how is the environment, the nature being affected, the wild animals being affected right now. That has to be international research that's supported by the Japanese government and internationally. And that's really important. So both the site, working on the site, I mean, we're running out of time. I mean, these tanks are 500,000 tons of contaminated water in these tanks that will not last for good, and there's no going to be no more space for these tanks, and there's, you know, there is radioactive discharge in the ocean. Also, we don't really know what happened at that accident yet. So that has to be examined internationally. Yes, I really agree. That's important.
Okay, great. So we'll move on to the next question. All right, you should be unmuted.
Hi, this is Judith Lomas in with Nuke Watch South in Atlanta, Georgia, again. I'm very interested in what to present to the Japanese consulate. So I understand then that the volcano issue and the calderas. Can I contact you apart from this phone call to prepare
yes.
for this?
Just type in Green Action Japan. Green Action,
okay.
Two separate words, Japan. We're a different group from the very good Green Action out in California, but the same name. But put Green Action
okay.
Japan. Yeah.
Okay.
I would say, look, you know, the Fukushima Daiichi site should be handled, taken care of, looked at internationally. But of course, very important is that it has to be done by Tekpoko in Japan too. You know, that's key. But that and also the victims of Fukushima, as Akira mentioned, a very good victims relief law was passed. It's not being implemented. So it's like, if you're going to, you know, Japan should implement this law for its victims. And the other is that the world is watching to see if those responsible for the Fukushima Daiichi accident will be prosecuted and found, you know, will be prosecuted. It will be examined, you know, who is responsible for what. And the world is watching. That's an important message to get there to the Japanese government. Hello? Yeah.
Hello?
Hello? Can you hear me?
This is Mo Headington. I'm calling you from the Chicago area. My question is focused on the food supply. And regardless of where in Japan you live, how do you go about choosing your produce, your dairy products, the foods that you bring home, not knowing exactly where they're coming from? And this question ties in with the fact that here in Illinois we have more reactors than any state, but we are also a heavy state in agriculture and concern about tainted product. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, it's really difficult. But I think in Japan, for example, the southwestern part of Japan is just, you know, relatively clean from the Fukushima Daiichi accident. So there, the best message is eat locally. Just eat locally. If you're living in like Tokyo and northeastern Japan, it's a much more difficult question to deal with. I think what we say is, for example, that we need the best monitoring, and especially people who are involved with organic farming. There's been a lot of effort for them. They monitor, and so that they can tell their customers this is the level, and then so that people can make informed decisions, you know, to know. But it is impossible to monitor everything or to get all that information when you go to supermarket. And so there's, in a way, no answer to that question except for looking at where the food is coming from, if it's possible. You know, that's the difficult part about this accident is, you know, it's like, why don't people just leave, or why don't people... Well, this is just large swathes of land with millions of people living in different areas, and you make a decision either, you know, to leave or to you know, constantly you know, make sure you try to reduce your level of exposure as much as possible. I know that's not a full answer, but that's the situation here.
Well, you know, it's really just one of the most obvious and persistent signs of the tragedy of one of these accidents. I mean, you know, I think we're still, you know, we're almost 30 years after the Chernobyl accidents, and, you know, and there's parts of, you know, Western Europe and, you know, and the states that are closer to the accident where you still got food restrictions and, you know, wildlife restrictions and all that kind of thing.
And I think, you know, the story is still in the making. I mean, look at how many reactors are in the U.S. I mean, this is really real. You know, like, for example, it's important to know that Fukushima Daiichi and living around there and Fukushima Daiichi was fine for 30 years. You know, it's fine. I mean, you know, yes, there are regular releases, but the next day it happened. You know, this is reality. And it's just unbelievable that Indian Point is there with, like, that huge population, just 60 miles or 60 kilometers from there, 38 miles. You know, Kyoto City is exactly about the same distance from Takahama. And we consider it a reality, you know, that we may well be contaminated. And what's going to happen to Kyoto, you know?
Right. So I think we have just a couple more questions, and then we'll wrap up. So why don't we take the next question? You should be unmuted.
Yes. I asked this question of the gentleman who spoke first. I'm curious, looking for anyone who can help me to be in touch with anyone who's looked at or willing to look at whether or not the U.S. government was involved with the tsunami through its weather modification program called High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, also known as HARP.
Yeah, I of course have heard of this issue, this concern, and I'm sorry, I do not know who you could be in touch with to address that issue. I'm sorry, I don't know, but.
I think this is, apart from the question of, you know, any active agency on the part of the U.S. government, I think well known for decades that the seismic activity, you know, near Japan posed this kind of risk. Was it not, Eileen?
Yes, that's the way we see it. It's, first of all, we're a land of earthquakes and volcanoes, and in the kind of accident, the earthquake that happened with the Tohoku Greater Earthquake has happened before in Japan, you know, all sorts of places. We're seismic, this is, you know, hundreds of years ago or before the U.S. government existed. And so we have to deal with that reality, that we have nuclear power on a land that's just, if you put dots of past earthquakes, it's just, you can't even see Japan, you know, that if you overlay it. And so we have to work with that reality. And that's the reality we're addressing. I'm sorry, I can't address the question that was asked.
Sure, sure. Okay, well, I think we're up to our last question right now. So why don't we go ahead and hear from, I think this is William Rice.
Hello, my name is Nancy Rice from Vermont. And, Eileen, you mentioned the question, why don't Japanese people leave? But it's my understanding that it is impossible for many of them because of restrictions by other governments. Is that true?
Restrictions by other governments?
Yeah, visa requirements and so forth for people to immigrate from Japan.
No, I mean, if people had the money, they could get a, you know, visa. I mean, not every country maybe, but leave. I mean, that's not, it's just not a viable, you know, choice for the public. Mm-hmm. I mean, what if you say, I don't know, LA should evacuate or New York City should evacuate. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's not a real option, is it? Or Chicago should evacuate. You know, it's not a real option.
Yes, sure.
That's why prevention is the real option.
Mm-hmm.
Because once something happens, you have to live with it. And you know, individuals who are wealthy or able can just pick up and go to the other end of the world. But it, even for them, I mean, that totally changes your life, doesn't it? And it's not because you decided you want to live somewhere. It's because you were forced to have to make that decision.
Well, and Eileen, this also goes to, you know, the point about the government opening up areas for, you know, for rehabilitation again. And the, you know, the real impossible situation that people who are concerned about being able to return, and you know, in terms of whether it's healthy or whether their children are going to be safe, are able to make that decision, and that the government is telling those residents or those citizens that that if they don't go back, that they're not eligible for any further compensation. So they really risk losing their entire livelihood in their homes.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's just a real threat to say you'll get this money if you go back in, but you won't if you choose to stay out. Once an area is declared okay, then that means, I mean, how much money do you get from your house that you still have a mortgage on if it's supposed to be, quote-unquote, officially okay to live there? And so this is the bind that people are being put into with the government, you know, saying this area is no longer needed to you know, you can go back in. And so you really, there should be international pressure saying people should have the right to choose. You know, if they want to go back in, then support them for their life back in the area. If they don't, then the same kind of support should be given to people who opt not to go back. And that's the kind of option that needs to be done. But instead, the government is taking measures to split people up, you know, where there's this infighting of victims. It creates a huge strain between victims when they're all victims. That is a problem, and that has to be looked at, and the whole world should see, you know, the methods of the Japanese government and examine it and critique it.
Well, thank you, Eileen. I think on that sobering note, I think that's where we have to end it for tonight. Really want to thank you and thank you, Dave Lockbaum, and also Akira Kawasaki, for your you know, amazing presentations and taking the time to spend with us tonight. And thank you all to everybody who called in tonight for participating and for taking an interest in this. We are going to continue to do these briefings on a more or less quarterly basis. We've got our next one scheduled, I believe, for June 24th, where we're going to be talking about the conflict between the nuclear industry and those of us who want a sustainable energy future over the efforts to promote nuclear as a climate solution. We're going to be joined by Amory Lovins then, and we expect we'll also be continuing to follow the issue of the proposal for restarting reactors in Japan, and we may invite Eileen back to give us an update on that at that time as well. So with that, again, I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight, and you can certainly, you know, find a recording of this of this presentation as well as the supplementary materials on NIRS' website at www.nirs.org. And with that, I bid you all a very good night. Thanks so much.
Thank you.